Yes.
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 The nature.
The nature.
And the modes of material nature.
The modes of material nature.
Artha.
Artha.
As effect.
As effect.
Jik vachaha.
Jik vachaha.
The seeing and talking of.
Seeing and talking of.
Yata, just as, manorata, mental concoction, daydream, daydream, svapna, a dream, sarvam, everything, indriyakam, produced by the senses, risha, false. Translation. It is fruitless to see and talk of the material modes of nature and their resultant so-called happiness and distress as if they were factual. When the mind wanders during the day and a man begins to think himself extremely important, or when he dreams at night and sees a beautiful woman enjoying with him, these are merely false dreams. Similarly, the happiness and distress caused by the material senses should be understood to be meaningless. Purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The happiness and distress derived from the activities of the material senses are not actual happiness and distress. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita speaks of happiness that is transcendental to the material conception of life. When our senses are purified of material contamination, they become atindriya, transcendental senses. And when the transcendental senses are engaged in the service of the master of the senses, Hrishikesh, one can derive real transcendental pleasure. Whatever distress or happiness we manufacture by mental concoction through the subtle mind has no reality. It is simply a mental concoction. One should therefore not imagine so-called happiness through mental concoction. Rather, the best course is to engage the mind in the service of the Lord, Hrishikesh, and thus feel real, blissful life. There is a Vedic statement, Apama Somam Amrita Avuma Apsarobir Vihama. With reference to such a conception, one wants to go to the heavenly planets to enjoy with the young girls there and drink soma rasa. Such imaginary pleasure, however, has no value. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, men of small intelligence worship the demigods, and their fruits are limited and temporary. Even if by fruit of activity or worship of the demigods one is elevated to the higher planetary systems for sense enjoyment, his situation is condemned in Bhagavad Gita as antavat, perishable. The happiness one enjoys in this way is like the pleasure of embracing a young woman in a dream. For some time it may be pleasing, but actually the basic principle is false. The mental concoctions of happiness and distress in this material world were compared to dreams because of their falseness. All thoughts of obtaining happiness by using the material senses have a false background and therefore have no meaning. Translation again, please repeat. It is fruitless.
It is fruitless.
To see and talk
of the material modes of nature
and their resultant so-called happiness
and distress
as if they were factual.
When
the mind wanders during the day and the man begins to think himself extremely important, or when he dreams at night and sees a beautiful woman enjoying with him, these are merely false dreams. Similarly, the happiness and distress caused by the material senses should be understood to be meaningless. Aumaganatanamandasya ginajana shalaka chakshurum vitamina tasai shirumena Shishetam yavadavastam stapitamina bhutave Soyam rupa kadamaya tatatya swapatamatikam He Krishna karma sutra dinabandhu jagarpate Kopesha kopika kanta radha kanta namaste Tantakam sarago rake radhe vindadamishmane Vishadamasite vanamani pagimbe Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Purnityananda Shri Arayita Karada Shri Gaura Bhakta Vinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Hamchaka Padri Vyasya Kiva Sandhya Vyata Patita Nama Hare Those queens, so attached to the body of their deceased husband, would not allow him the last rites in that body of cremation, which created a disturbance in the natural rhythms of life and death. And the piteous cries of the queens actually evoked the sympathy of Yamaraj, who came down as a young child to speak words of wisdom to these aggrieved queens. And Hiranyakashipu is repeating the words of Yamaraj to relieve the grief in his own relatives. But actually, we tend in this day and age to become very amazed to hear the basic elementary ingredients of spiritual knowledge from anyone outside of our own entourage of devotees. But really, the knowledge the eternal nature of the soul as distinct from the temporary nature of the body is not rare. You could probably go to just about any library in the kingdom, in the capital of Maya, which I guess would be America, and find shelves of knowledge regarding the eternal nature of the soul as distinct from the temporary nature of the body. So it's not really a very rare thing to experience such knowledge. What is rare is to come across someone who has realized this truth. So the theoretical knowledge is available just about anywhere. I mean, we're surrounded by karmis who just think that the body, the pursuit of the pleasures of the body, mind and senses is all in all, but even then you can reason with very easily, just like Hiranyakashipu is doing here with his demon ancestors, and they easily understand by simple analogies that the soul is eternal by nature, distinct from the temporary dreams of the body and mind. It's not very unusual to come across such instructions, such theoretical understanding. What is rare is to come across someone who has realized this knowledge. And there's a major difference in the results of hearing theoretical knowledge and hearing realized knowledge. Realized knowledge means it has been assimilated in the heart. And one who has realized this knowledge can impart it to others and is inclined to do so, because realization awakens the brotherhood of all souls as children of the common Father. And therefore one is inspired to impart this realized knowledge to the suffering masses. Whereas theoretical knowledge is commonly known as crematorium renunciation. And even without words of wisdom being spoken, it is typical that at a crematorium, one comes to realize the temporary nature of the body. And they become detached for a little while, but not for long. Because if that detachment is not based on actual realization of a higher principle, then the senses are just going to find another source of attachment. And this attachment and its nature, Krishna describes in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, verse 63, which is interesting to consider in relationship to the following verse, 64, one being the antithesis of the other. Verse 63, Krishna tells the nature of those who have not realized the basic spiritual knowledge. While contemplating the objects of the senses, one becomes attracted. From that initial attraction, attachment develops. And from that attachment, frustration is inevitable, because the senses, the objects of the senses, cannot provide any substantial pleasure. They may provide an illusory sense of temporal pleasure, which is itself the source, the seeds of pain. So therefore frustration. And then anger with whoever we identify as being the frustrating agent to our coveted material desires. And then from anger, delusion, bewilderment of memory, loss of intelligence, and fall down again onto the material plane. So what is the use of such theoretical knowledge or such crematorium renunciation, which is short-lived and just leads to further repetition of attraction and attachment? It's basically meaningless. So the antithesis of this trend is given in the following verse by Sri Krishna. By following the regulative principles of freedom, one can attract the mercy of the Lord. And that mercy of the Lord frees one from the dualities of attraction and aversion. Because attraction and aversion are simply same, different sides of the same coin of material conditioning, which means aversion to Krishna. Conditioned souls become attracted and attached to things that offer the illusion of pleasure. And they're averse to those things which provide the sensation of pain. But the attraction is the source of the pain. So, and both the attraction and the aversion are indications of our aversion to Krishna and the service of Krishna, which is the root cause of our
delusions and bewilderment. So, by following the regulative principles of freedom, which basically means the four regulative prohibitions, but the most important regulative principle is to always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. And this doesn't mean some theoretical remembrance. Actual remembrance of Krishna is a result of the blessings of those great souls who have developed that sustained remembrance of Krishna, which is realized in their lives as dedication to the service of Krishna. And in the service of Krishna, considering only Krishna's pleasure, as revealed through the Guru and the Vaishnavas, one is freed from the dualities of attraction and aversion, and attachment and hate. And therefore, he's also freed from the reactions. So, actual realized knowledge comes from approaching a self-realized soul and inquiring submissively. Submissively means surrendering preconceived notions of what is real and desirable. And most of all, seva, rendering service. It is that rendering of service which is the expression of our will to know what to reconcile with Krishna, to end our competition with Krishna, our envy of Krishna, which is the root cause of our condition, is the source of our false ego and the illusions of material nature. So, Krishna's pleasure. And not considering our own pleasures or pains or benefits or losses in regards to serving the pleasures of Sri Krishna. And of all those who are surrendered to the pleasure of Krishna, all great devotees acknowledge that the example of the gopis is the best and the highest. Their degree of dedication, sacrifice, and surrender is unparalleled, as in the case of Krishna's fictitious headache, and seeking relief. Narada requested the dust the feet of the Brahmins to relieve Krishna's headache, and they refused. Never could we place the dust of our feet upon the head of the Lord, because the consequence would be eternal damnation and unending suffering. So they refused Krishna's request. But the gopis, hearing of Krishna's fictitious headache, and the only cure being the dust of their lotus feet, since the Brahmins refused, were immediately prepared to suffer eternal damnation for some temporary relief of Krishna's fictitious headache. Similar is the case. Of course, this is the mood, the example of love, which Lord Chaitanya came to experience for himself, and in so doing to share with the world. So, in Mahaprabhu's Leela, such a wonderful personification of compassion revealed in the prayers of Vasudeva Dutta, who prayed to Mahaprabhu that my heart breaks to see the sufferings of all these conditioned souls. So, if you could answer my prayer by transferring all their karma, whether it's
suffering upon my head, then let me suffer eternal damnation and bondage if they can be delivered. That will be my highest satisfaction. In hearing this prayer, Mahaprabhu's heart just melted and tears flowed from his eyes. And he said, "This is not so astonishing considering that you are none other than Prahlad Maharaj. But if that is your desire, that the universe be delivered, it will be so, because Krishna's desire is to please his devotees. But you will not have to suffer the consequence, because Krishna can absolve the sufferings of the living entities and all their conditioning, if that is the prayer of his pure devotee. Because Krishna's main concern is to serve his servants, please them in all respects." This is love. And love is expressed in sacrifice. And what does sacrifice mean? The desire to do anything that is pleasurable to the beloved. And the desire to forsake anything that is imagined to be desirable to our own selfish interest, which is our own enemy, our selfish interest. So, in the material world, karmas are the category of those who seek to exploit material nature due to attachment. Gyanis are those who renounce due to aversion. Whereas the devotee accepts and embraces everything and everyone. And that kind of dedication leads to the realm of Krishna's confidence in Krishna's birth. We have the wonderful example of the sacrifice performed by Vasudeva when his brother-in-law Kamsa, in an instant, transformed from the most respectable gentleman driving the chariot of his newlywed sister and brother-in-law. When one line of prophecy spoken from the sky about how her eighth child will be the cause of your death, and in an instant, he drops the reins, draws his sword, grabs her hair, and is ready to behead his beloved sister right in the middle of her marriage ceremony. And Vasudeva was pleading with him, "This is not a great gentlemanly thing to do, and people will not think very highly of you." But so selfish was his mentality that he could not be dissuaded by reason. So Vasudeva had to promise, "I will hand over children, if there are any, and we can do with them as you see fit." So Vasudeva, true to his word, handed over all the children to be slaughtered just after their birth. So after, you know, the sacrifice that Mataji goes through, you know, months of pregnancy, the pain of childbirth, and then seeing and interacting with a child who she'd never seen before, being within her womb, and the attachment and the natural and proper maternal sentiments to be ripped away and slaughtered before their very eyes. Inconceivable sacrifice. But true to his word, Vasudeva, every year, handed over to the children. So, it was after this whole course of events started to change, just after Aristasura was sent, because Kamsa suspected that Krishna and Balaram were actually the seventh and eighth children of Vasudeva Devaki. They did not really have any direct proof of this. But he was sending his demons. He sent Aristasura, the personification of Aristotelian logic. Is it? Trying to fathom and bring Krishna within the
three-dimensional limitations of one's own grasp. And that bull demon was liberated by the loving hands of Sri Krishna. And the deliverance of Aristasura marks the beginning of the end of Krishna's Braj Leela, which was Narada's cue to go to Kamsa and tell him that actually Jashoda gave birth to a girl, not a boy. And the boy who she's raising, as well as the boy that Rohini is raising, are Devaki's seventh and eighth issue. So, the child prophesied to kill you is flourishing in Vrindavan. Now, Kamsa had suspected this, but nobody that he didn't actually have proof before. And as soon as he heard these words, he stepped outside the view of Narada and drew his sword to go kill Vasudeva and Devaki. But Narada stopped him and said, no, don't kill him. Because then Nanda Maharaj will find out and he'll flee with Krishna and Balaram. So, and don't tell Vasudeva that you know what I've just informed you, because he will tell Nanda Maharaj and he'll also flee if he just hears that we know that you know what's going on. So on some pretext, just imprison them, Vasudeva Devaki, again, and arrange a grand festival. Because Krishna likes festivals. And as part of the festivities, make a special wrestling arena. And make it so attractive that Krishna would be in a very sportive mood and want to wrestle. And of course, he told his elephant keepers and everything to make all arrangements to kill Krishna at every possible opportunity. So, what wonderful affection and compassion Narada Muni is showing, having incited Kamsa to kill Krishna, to imprison Vasudeva Devaki. But he knew that if he had them imprisoned, then Krishna would come and rescue them, and then he would receive blessings from Vasudeva Devaki. So, Narada actually showed his compassion by informing Kamsa of the truth that he had not yet realized. So then, Kamsa told Keshi, who in Braj Leela is the personification of pride. And it's interesting to understand his nature, because the supreme mercy of Krishna is personified in Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And by his mercy, one can actually make rapid advancement on the path of sadhana. And if one thinks that this rapid advancement is due to his own merit or glory, he develops the mentality of a wild stallion, such as Keshi, who thinks he can just gallop right into Vrindavan on his own accord. But what does he need? When Keshi was, you know, galloping into Vrindavan, so huge was this horse that his mane was scattering the clouds and throwing the airplanes of the demigods, you know, out of their orbit. And his whinnying was terrifying and terrorizing the whole countryside, and his thundering hooves was like earthquakes causing miscarriages amongst all the pregnant Pantages. And then when he came galloping into Vrindavan, you know, actually Krishna didn't kill Aristasura. He considered Aristasura so abominable. Because Krishna, it was just twilight time and Krishna was ready for Rasa Leela, but here comes Aristasura. I mean, it was actually very beneficial because it provided the opportunity for Radha and Shyamakam to be excavated. But Krishna considered him so abominable that he wouldn't even kill him. And according to Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, Krishna just wrung him out like a wet sponge and then threw him away. You know, after he tried to kick him, he grabbed his hoofs, spun around, just threw him away. And he wouldn't even kill him. He considered him so degraded. And Yamaraj appeared and killed him. Krishna was so disgusted with this demon, he wouldn't even show him the respects of killing him. So then here comes Keshi. Now, Krishna likes for our pride to become fully mature so they can be completely destroyed. So when here comes galloping in Keshi, Krishna held out his hand and said, "You want to eat something?" You know, if you watch Chandra Purnchabhu in his new mule, he tries to make friends with him. He holds out his hand with some nice grain soaked in molasses. Let's make friends. That's exactly what Krishna did himself. Keshi galloping towards him to kill him. He held out his hand. Do you want to eat something? And he just came galloping up. But according to Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, Maharaj Pariksit would have been too disturbed if he heard that Krishna's lotus-like hand and his lotus-like arm had to go into the horrible mouth of this hideous demon and be scratched by his rakshasa teeth. So actually what happened is that Krishna's hand, his tender, delicate, cooling, soothing, lotus-like hand, because as we approach him, he reciprocates accordingly, became like a red-hot iron ball, which first of all knocked out all the carnivorous teeth in this rakshasa horse. And then Krishna's lotus fist, glowing like molten iron, just slid right down his throat, and he met with the burning quality of Krishna, which was the appropriate redemption for his pride. And then he fell dead. And then Kamsa saw he had to go through with Narada's advice to have this wrestling festivity. So Kamsa was so learned in the art of kama and artha, of securing personal interest by political endeavor, and you know, acting like a friend when you're actually just trying to use someone. So he told Akura that, "Look," and he pointed out with his own hand, "I have a brand new chariot." And he was thinking that Akura is like, you know, most conditioned souls who love to get a new car and immediately want to take it for a test drive, as if a new car needs a test drive. So when Kamsa pointed out to Akura, "Look, I have a new chariot. Want to take it for a ride? Go to Vrindavan and bring Krishna and Balaram to the great festival we're about to celebrate." So Akura was able to understand this is the will of the Lord, because he understood he was going to be drafted into bringing Krishna and Balaram, but he could not ask them to get on the chariot that had been used by Kamsa. That would just be too abominable. So when he saw that, by divine arrangement, he was being offered a brand new chair. He said, "Well, this, then I can give Krishna Balaram a ride. And then I'll see, you know, the deliverance of Vasudeva and Devaki and all these wonderful things." So then he went to Vrindavan, meditating on Krishna Balaram. And, you know, the history thereafter. They came, killed Kamsa, released Vasudeva and Devaki. And in the wrestling arena, Krishna revealed himself according to the rasa in everyone's heart, thus fulfilling the desires and revealing himself accordingly to everyone's realization. So, oh, and Narada Muni, he actually had to go invite Krishna and encourage him to come to Mathura. So
Narada Muni, knowing that, okay, Krishna's Raksha Lila is ending, it's completed, he asked him, please come and fulfill the desires of the devotees of Mathura. And he informed Krishna that as Yogesh, the master of all mystic potencies, you can both come to Mathura and stay at Vrindavan, so nobody is really going to be bereft of your association. But Krishna said, don't you know that I act according to my own sweet will? So why are you asking me to do something? And Narada told him, because you are the super soul. And as a super soul, you inspired me to ask you. And I know the general sequence of your leelas, having been through them so many times, which is just like a general outline. But I want to see in the future your potency and the potency of your pure devotees, which assists and empowers the devotees to transcend the influence of the illusory energy. So after this, Krishna decided to have one more game in Vrindavan, so they played the game of sheep and shepherds and thieves. And Vyomasura was an unexpected, uninvited thief who wasn't playing the game according to the rules, but was taking the cowherd boys and putting them in a cave. And then as he put them in one by one, he put a big boulder over the mouth of the cave to suffocate them. And then, you know, Krishna realized that there's fewer and fewer boys playing the game every minute, so there's only four or five left, and something is wrong. These cowherd boys, I mean the sheep and the shepherds and the thieves are all disappearing. What is going on? So he detected a demon playing the part of a thief, and he suffocated him. As we approach Krishna, he reciprocates accordingly. He wanted to suffocate Krishna. He wanted to end the cowherd boys. He was suffocated. So, but conversely, for devotees, if we approach him, not necessarily in love, because we may not have love for Krishna. But the assurance is that bhakti is absolute, the divine energy of Krishna. The means and the goal and the path and the destination are all one and the same. So how to try to please Krishna and invoke his love if we're feeling bereft of that love? Same thing, 264. By following the regular principles of freedom, this sacrifice of following regular principles for Krishna's pleasure, that attracts the mercy of the Lord, which we have rejected since time immemorial due to our selfish desires and false ego. And we again attract that mercy into our lives by sincerely following the regulative principles. And how does that mercy manifest? By freeing us from the attractions to imagined pleasures, the aversion to imagine pain, which is all a dream, as Hiranyakashipu is explaining here. This imagining ourselves to be the body and things in relation to the senses as being desirable or undesirable is all a dream. There's a night dream and there's a day dream, but it's all illusion and has nothing to do with reality. So the mercy of the Lord, which is attracted by sincerely following the regulative principles, frees us from these dualities of attraction and aversion, which perpetuates our bondage and illusion, and begins to bring some light into the dungeon of our conditioned existence. The mercy of the Lord also means divine intervention, which is essential. Because the plight of Vasudeva and Devaki is something like the plight of all living entities, even devotees in this material world. We're incarcerated. Vasudeva and Devaki were placed into a prison. And Kamsa
was helpful because he is fear personified. That fear of material conditioning kept Vasudeva and Devaki fixed on the mercy of the Lord, which took birth in their, from their pure hearts and freedom from that dungeon of Kamsa's prison. So, the descriptions of the scripture are literal. The pastimes of Krishna aren't reality. There is no reality other than Krishna, his pastimes, his holy name, his devotees and devotional service. Everything else is a grand illusion. In material existence, we have taken assistance from Maya and created a dungeon with walls so formidable that it is impossible to escape the network of our own conditioning. Any endeavor to become free simply further entangles us in the web, like a spider web, of material existence. When a bug gets trapped in a spider web, he gets stuck. And he tries to free himself, he gets more stuck, he tries harder, until he's finally so incarcerated, he's lost. So that is the nature of the living entity's endeavors to free himself. He has created this dungeon with walls, impenetrable. And it's dark inside. Which means the light of transcendental knowledge is blocked by our own false ego. So the mercy of the Lord is essential. When Haridas Thakur was explaining the various stages of chanting the holy name in the assembly of the Madhundars, there was a discussion going on about liberation. And they asked Haridas Thakur to speak. And he said that liberation is not the fruit of the chanting of the holy name. Liberation, sought after by the jnanis, is the dim reflection of Namabhas. And he explained that Namabhas, the dim glimmer of reflection of the illuminating rays of the holy name, is like the pre-dawn indirect light. The sun's rays have not yet crested the horizon, but the indirect infusion of the rays, which are over the horizon, dispels some of the darkness and gloom of the night. And then you can just barely begin to make out forms in the night. And then you begin to see what's there and what's not, and your fear of the unknown and ghosts and demons and thieves and undesirable, fearful things, it's diminished, and you see, well, they're not there. They were just, you know, imagined in fear. But there's just enough light to see what's actually there. And then when the sun actually arises above the horizon, that's like Shivana. Namabhas gives liberation from all the fears and attachments and aversions to conditioned life. Namabhas. Shudanam reveals everything in its actual nature. And what is the actual nature of the world? Since our perception is that of either night dream or daydream, we do not even perceive the actual nature of the world we live in. And therefore, we have the scripture, and we have the guru. And Srila Prabhupada told us, don't try to see through your eyes, which are so deceptive. See through your ears. Because transcendental sound emanating from the spiritual world has the ability to awaken remembrance of the spiritual world within our hearts. It has the ability, transcendental sound, to penetrate into the darkness where none of the other spiritual senses can make contact to the reality. The transcendental sound has this ability to bring an image from far away and reveal it within our hearts. So, the nature of reality and the nature, the actual nature of even the phenomenal world as it is beautifully described and portrayed by Srila Prabhupada in his Illuminations of the Bhagavat, which is something he envisioned printing with Illuminations before he even came to America and was invited to a conference in Japan where he knew there would be artists available. He wanted to go to have the artists do paintings of Illuminations of the Bhagavat. And what is the text? It is Shukadeva Goswami's description of the natural beauty in Vrindavan in the rainy season and what lessons we can glean from the natural order of Braj. So Braj Lila is the revelation of nature in its most pristine beauty and glory and purity and meaning. But even material nature is a reflection of that divine nature. And material nature, it has substance, even though it's temporary. The substance is not something to enjoy or renounce, but is something to learn from. The substance of the material world is that it imparts lessons. The beauty of material nature is that it points to something beyond itself, of which it is just a reflection. And the reflection, just like the namabhas, is very meaningful and very useful into leading to the pure vision and realization. So everything in the material world is meant to teach us something about our eternal nature. But to decode the message of material nature requires submission to one who actually sees things as they are. And that is the spiritual master and the Vaishnavas. So, the message that Shukadeva Goswami is imparting in his describing the lessons to learn from the natural beauty in Braj in the rainy season is how to see Krishna's beauty, hear Krishna's message, and feel Krishna's love, even in the perverted reflection of the spiritual world that we encounter every day in our experience. But this requires the mercy of the Lord to free us from the attractions of the senses, any one of which, or to speak of all of which, can completely deviate us from the goal and purpose of life. So by the regular principles and seeking to please the Vaishnavas, the Guru and Krishna, by acting for their pleasure only, attracts the mercy of the Lord, which begins to restore our natural proper vision of things as they are. So here, in the Bhagavatam, Hiranyakashipu, citing Yamaraj, is seeking to console the grieving, lamenting queens with some temporary insight to relieve their grief. But the purpose of the scripture is not for our pleasure or relief of pain, but for our education, for which pain is actually more conducive. When Krishna was leaving Hastinapur and Queen Kunti was begging, and toward the conclusion of her prayers, let the calamities come again and again and again,
For in those situations, we're prone to see you again and again and again. And darshan of you, Krishna, means no longer darshan of the face of repeated birth and death. So what does birth and death have to teach us is the lesson we should seek. Not how to become consoled or relieved of the grief at the death of a loved one. But what is the lesson? You know, death is not like an event in life. It's like a current. It's all around us at all times, everywhere, just a current. What is the lesson? We see everywhere living entities are being born, living entities are dying. We rejoice in birth, we lament seeing death, but what is the lesson? Krishna is revealing to us the temporary futility of egotistic exploits. And he's revealing to us, you have a given time between the birth you rejoice and the death you lament. And you cry in ecstasy when you have a child, you cry in lamentation, you lose a parent. But for the soul, there's neither birth nor death. And for the enlightened soul, birth and death are equally beautiful because they're telling us something about Krishna. That our human life has a beginning and an end. It's precious. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to continue living like an animal and just going further and further away from Krishna? Or are you going to see the unique opportunity inherent to the human form of life and invoke Krishna's mercy. Pray that he gives us the vision to see his glory, to feel his love, to hear his call, calling the conditioned soul back home, as Mahaprabhu, just when the eastern horizon of the kingdom becomes tinged with the red of the coming rising sun, Jeev Jago, Jeev Jago, 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 Kota Nita Jago. Wake up, sleeping souls. You're sleeping complacently on the lap of the witch, Maya. Why a witch? Because she bewitches us into taking an illusion to be real, as into taking the temporary to be eternal. And what is he doing? He is propagating the chanting of the holy names of the Lord. Because since time immemorial, Krishna has been feeling our plight more than we have. And waiting, as Krishna tells Gopakumar in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, I was waiting when this life or the next or the next or the next will you again turn to me? I was like a dancing fool, just anticipating that in each life in which I was with you, accompanying you as a super soul, you would again turn to me and return to me. And finally, I had to violate my own, not violate, but transcend my own law and take direct intervention in your life, arranging your birth and go over down here, coming personally as your guru, taking direct intervention in your life. Krishna honors the living entity's free will to ignore him, to forget him, to rebel against him, to cover our eyes, to cover our ears, to fill our hearts with all kinds of false feelings and thoughts and relationships. Forgive Krishna. He's always waiting. Waiting. When will we listen to the words of the Vedas, the words of the Vaishnavas, and try to please him by following the regulative principles of freedom, which attracts his mercy, which frees us from the dualities of attachment and aversion, and trains us to seek his pleasure, his message, his guidance, his love, his call, in every aspect, even of our material sojourn, and When we finally come to the realization that our only hope is in the holy name of the Lord, and we call for His mercy, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, as Srila Prabhupada said, like a child crying for a mother, in a helpless state of mind, we're helpless. But Krishna's mercy is sufficient and is really all we need to deliver us from our conditioning. Our conditioning is like a wall, an impenetrable wall of a dungeon of which we cannot possibly escape by any individual or combined effort. But when we call upon the mercy of the Lord, we are asking Him, break down this wall of illusion that separates me from the light and love of reality. So, Krishna comes and performs wonderful pastimes. He does not just speak words of wisdom which are sympathetic to our exploitative tendencies. That's what Yamakashipu is doing here. He's speaking words of wisdom which are sympathetic to the aversion to Godhead and His family members. But when Krishna comes, He performs marvelous activities which is meant to confront all our limited ideas of what's real and unreal and possible and desirable. And when we surrender to His inconceivable ability and will, and right to do whatever He wants, whenever He likes, we are submitting to His mercy, which alone can set us free from this world of death. And His mercy restores our proper vision to find our way, which begins by calling upon His name to deliver us from our self-imposed illusions and bring us back home into the realm of His eternal loving pastimes. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Well, it all boils down to one, which is always forget Krishna, never forget Krishna. And then there's unlimited support of rules and regulations, of which for us, the four that are so essential that they constitute our vows for initiation are the prohibitions to the four pillars of sinful life. It's more than just the gross manifestations of no mediating. It means no violence. No intoxication. It doesn't just mean drugs and alcohol. It means anything that perpetuates our illusion. No illicit sex. So gambling isn't just at the casino. It's anything that's gambling our precious time in the human form of life, including frivolous activities, or mental speculation. So we vow to avoid the four gross manifestations of sinful life, the four pillars of sinful life, who were meant to, go from the gross prohibitions into the more subtle distractions and delusions from the purpose of life. But the main regulative principle, which contains all the positive and negative, is always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. the four essential vows for initiation. Because those are the very abodes of Kali, personification of quarrel and hypocrisy. And any interaction with him makes spiritual perfection unattainable. But basically, anything that's conducive to remembrance of Krishna, we accept. Anything that contributes to forgetfulness of Krishna, we reject. Or Sharanagati, humility, delegation of the self, accepting all things favorable for devotional service, rejecting all things unfavorable, accepting the Lord as one's only protector. The son of Nanda hears the prayers of one who approaches in this mood of Sharanagati. So, surrender. It's not a very good word because it usually implies force. But Sharanagati implies love, a loving submission to the will of Krishna. Anyway, the rules and regulations which Srila Prabhupada said are so extensive and that we would faint if we heard all of those regulations are condensed into the basic regulative principle of always remembering Krishna and forgetting Krishna. That's not a theoretical thing. To always remember for Krishna, never forget Krishna. We have to follow the instructions of the Guru and the Vaishnavas. Not that the rules and regulations themselves will protect us. They'll protect us from the gross violations in attracting the person. But we have to go further and seek only Krishna's pleasure, Krishna's service, and the satisfaction of Sri Guru and the Vaishnavas and all our activities. That will be favorable to the remembrance of Krishna. So there's many categories and unlimited varieties of rules and regulations. For the sum and substance of it all is always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. But that's not a theoretical thing. That's totally dependent on the grace of Krishna. So following the regulative principles protects us from gross violations to the path of bhakti. But the spirit in following the rules and regulations should be to attract the mercy of the Lord, which is the only empowerment to award that realization by which we can actually always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. The essence is that, always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. And there's, you know, unlimited varieties of rules and regulations to help us achieve that one as essential principle.
I know a lot of different devotees who, you know, following everything, and yet when they have some kind of near-death experience, you know, car accident or car goes off the road or something happens, and I always ask, well, did you remember Krishna when that was happening? And they go, oh, no. So I know it's by the mercy of Krishna that we remember him enough times, but like, what do we do? Like, just pray to Krishna to help us to always remember him? Why is that happening?
Yes, of course we have to pray, because death is the final exam. So we may be passing so many intermediate exams, and then every now and then we get a warning at the final exam, and some pass and some fail. It means we're not prepared yet for the final exam. We have to keep practicing. Yes, it is only the mercy of the Lord, but that is attracted and realized according to our sincerity and practice. So if you're passing your little exams and then
a warning of the final exam comes up, and you call out something of the beloved name of Krishna, then you know that keep practicing, try hard. But it's not your own effort that's going to do it. Your own effort is helpful in expressing and showing your sincerity to both yourself and Krishna. But ultimately, it's only the mercy of the Lord that can allow us to remember Him. Because material nature has just the opposite effect of forgetfulness of Krishna. And we're so conditioned that only the mercy of the Lord can award us redemption from our own self-imposed sentence to remember Him in the critical hour of death. So if we get a warning and we fail, we've got to try harder. Of course, a lot of devotees do remember and call out Krishna much better when they think they're going to die than when they thought they were going to live. And that's why Queen Kunti was praying, let the calamities come together again. Because the difficulties, the dangerous situations, the hazardous, are more conducive to remembering Krishna. You can't. Remembrance of Krishna in your mind will not help. It has to be an internal awareness that we're completely dependent on the mercy of the Lord. And our own ability will not save us. Only the mercy of the Lord. So therefore, devotees accept with gratitude dangerous situations, hazardous opportunities, anguish, pain, suffering are more conducive to remembering Krishna and help us live in life. Then when things are actually going pretty smoothly in accordance with my desire and according to our plan, that's actually a more dangerous situation. Because the tendency of the conditioned soul is when things go right, he takes credit for it. And when things go wrong, he blames God. But the nature of the devotee is he's grateful for whatever Krishna sends. But devotees tend to be more afraid of things going smoothly than things going wrong. Because the real danger is that we think that we're in control and we forget our helpless condition and utter dependence on the mercy of the Lord. So Krishna reminds us every now and then to see if we've actually learned our lessons. And if we have learned our lessons, we should not become proud or become forgetful of Him. And if we haven't learned our lessons, then we should become more humble and try harder. And most of all, just to be grateful for every opportunity that Krishna sends to help us remember and understand our helpless condition and our dependence on His divine mercy, which is all condensed in the Mahamantra.
Talking about the gambling thing, one thing that everyone does in their life is they plan, and you know, it is said, you know, some of the life goes that if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So it's like a very natural thing, and you know, even as the bodies, we are told that we should be practical and we should plan our life and you know, things like that. And then you also make the statement that, you know, when we plan and it happens like that, then we become proud. So how do we really understand this planning thing then, you know? Is planning your life gambling, or if it is not, then, you know, how do we plan, how much to plan, you know?
Well, the scriptures, we hear so many instructions on not making plans, like we should have. That's one of the instructions he gave to Maharaj Yudhisthira. You become free from anxiety by not making plans. Well, first of all, the goal of life is not to become free of anxiety. And when Bhishma says, don't make plans, don't make material plans. we should, plan our lives and how we can terminate our conditioning existence as effectively as possible. We should make plans to perfect our life. We should not make material plans. And even our plans of spiritual life have to be flexible to the will of the Lord. And we should not take our plans as being all in all. We should make plans to show the devotees and the Guru and Krishna that we're trying to utilize our life efficiently to attain the goal. But Srila Prabhupada was always making all kinds of plans. But he was always very attentive to the will of the Lord and to adjust all his plans to the revelation of Krishna's arrangements and desires. That's how to deal with planning. As far as the other thing about gambling is the illusion that you can get ahead at somebody else's loss. That you can gain by somebody else's loss. That's one of the big pitfalls of gambling. Because freedom from material conditioning means we have to settle all our debts. Whatever we've exploited has to be repaid to the team. And if you think you can cut corners or profit at somebody else's loss, that's going to have to be repaid in return. So, no gambling, it's just we're honest. You don't get ahead by exploiting or taking advantage of somebody else's loss. And planning should be just to attain the purpose of life, which is devotional service. And even our plans in that regard should be flexible to how the will of Krishna unfolds in our lives.
How to understand the will of Krishna?
Huh?
How to understand what is the will of Krishna? Is it through
Krishna speaks to the assembled Vaishnavas and the Guru. And that doesn't mean that in the assembled Vaishnavas you can go from one to the other and ask, what does Krishna mean in this? And you're going to get the same answer. It's very unlikely that you can ever go to any individual in the assembly of Vaishnavas, ask one question and get any two giving the same answer as far as what it means. So there again, we're not talking about theory. We're talking about harmony. What is harmonious in the assembly of devotees? That is the will of Krishna. That is the will of Srila Prabhupada. That you'll express your love for me by how you cooperate together. And that doesn't mean just, doing what you're told or being able to sit down and look somebody in the face and take prasadam with them when you really don't like them. It means displacing any envy that comes between us by putting Krishna's will in the center of all our thoughts, relationships, endeavors. Or the other way to look at it is if you go to each member in the assembly of Vaishnavas and say, what is Krishna saying in this? And they all give you a completely different answer. It means whatever Krishna is saying has so many different dimensions to it, which can be revealed in the different Vaishnavas. And also, a point is understood by the thesis, the antithesis, and the... what's the other? Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Look at the Vaishnava lines. The four Vaishnava lines. They're all different. They all have slightly different, not exactly different teachings, different emphasis in their teachings. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took two essential teachings from each of the four sampradayas, harmonized them, synthesized them, and revealed the higher perspective. And what they're all expressing. So that synthesis, that harmony, is the indication of the will of Krishna. Just like, Nubrahman is classic. You may have so many individuals attempting the same outcome, and it just doesn't happen. And they all have their different ideas of how it should be. And, everybody trying to achieve the same goal just results in so much conflict. There is something missing. It's the love and respect and appreciation and the mutual dealings which Krishna deems foremost in any particular outcome. And if an outcome is being frustrated, a desirable outcome upon which we all agree, then there's something in the relationships that needs to be refined before the empowerment will fulfill, before the mercy and empowerment to fulfill the desired objective. Srila Prabhupada wanted a place of pilgrimage where Krishna's pastime will be revealed. That is not to be achieved by any managerial or expertise or any other endeavor, although all these things are helpful and useful. It's going to be revealed in relationships of harmonious nature. Because that's what attracts Krishna. And Krishna's mercy blossoms in a field of harmony. We make our plans, but we have to adjust them to the will of Krishna, which is revealed in the collective pleasure of the Vaishnavas, not in any particular theoretical statement of each one of them, but in the collective harmony and unity of the Vaishnava body, which is the extension of Srila Prabhupada's will, the life of his mission.
You were mentioning about if we cannot gain by taking someone else's moves.
Right.
You were saying that profit, when we try to take profit, then, if we try to make profit by making someone else lose, then we have to actually repay that debt. But now we see that in this world, even if we have to do any small business, that means someone else is going to lose if we have to profit.
Not necessarily. Or you take it in terms of fundraising in the Vaishnava community. You're trying to solicit funds and contributions from others. The Vaishnava way to solicit donations is to offer something that we have that we want to share, and accepting their reciprocation in a way that no one loses, everyone gains. So we may be dependent on donors for contributions to sustain the mission, but we should be very attentive that we are giving them something as a loving exchange for their offerings. And then no one will be losing them. And everyone will be working cooperatively for the upliftment of the whole, which is what Holy Dawn means, and what in creating a replica of the Holy Dawn necessitates. Interactions in which everyone is assisting, encouraging, inspiring one another. That we work together as a whole in harmony for the pleasure of the Vaishnavas, Guru and Krishna. And the result will be harmony, which necessitates loving relationships and sacrifice false ego on the sacrificial altar of the holy name, meaning coming together in Sankirtan. And the fruit of our japa, going into the depths of our heart, purifying false ego for the illumination of the holy name, is meant to come together in more harmonious loving interactions expressed as sankirtan, which is not limited to devotees joining in the temple and singing and dancing together, although that is the essence of it. Sankirtan means samyak kirtan. Utilizing, it means on one hand, all individuals coming together in glorifying our names. It also means utilizing everything, all elements, all assets, all attributes in the collective glorification of the whole being. But that necessitates, you know, purifying our own individual hearts, which is not the complete goal. The goal of our endeavors to purify our individual hearts is for the sake of harmonious, loving interactions with the representatives of the Holy Name, who are those devotees who assist us in our sankirtan mission. So Krishna's will is confirmed where there's harmony. It's revealed in harmony. Now, of course, deeper harmony necessitates episodes of conflict. Now, when you have a certain level of harmony, and you're trying to go to a deeper level of harmony, it means certain things have to be broken down and undone and for expansion and deepening. But you have to see that it's a progressive path towards more meaningful relationships and offering to the pleasure. So we should not be bewildered by episodes of conflict if we see that they're leading to a deeper harmony and purity. But if we see only deepening conflict and competition, then we have to consider if something is lacking. And if something is lacking, first thing is to look in your own heart and see, where is my deficiency? And then, not in a critical way, but in an earnest way to improve on the standards, try to work cooperatively, collectively, with the individual elements who are trying to work together for the mission of Shri Guru. Planning is not just do what you're told.
And it could be a way of like just, I guess essentially just avoiding your lack of Christian consciousness, you're trying to do something.
Well, it can. I mean, you may be planning just to, perpetuate your aversion to surrender. You may be planning to compensate for confronting your own fears or inabilities. We don't want that kind of planning. We want planning to fulfill the purpose of life. We want planning to fulfill the mission of Srila Prabhupada. We have a perfect example of all these things in Srila Prabhupada. He's always making plans. What were his plans? To share the gift that he had been given. We don't want to make plans for our own selfish ambitions. That is detrimental and conflicting by nature. And we don't want to make separate plans. We want to make plans that are aligned and harmonious for the plans that Srila Prabhupada made to spread Krishna consciousness. And individually, to perfect our own life, in harmony with the perfection of Srila Prabhupada's mission, of which we're a part. Or going back to Bija Dev, I said, don't make plans. You know, basically, there's mundane and there's absolute. We don't do what's mundane, other than what's absolutely necessary. Even that should be aligned with the absolute goal. So everything should be adjusted to the absolute goal, which is freedom from the ignorance of false ego and selfishness, and harmonious contribution to Srila Prabhupada's mission. So all our plans, everything, should be aligned for the purpose and the goal of everything we do, and say the thing, which is the pleasure of Vaishnava's glorification. So we make plans for that goal, not for anything separate, contrary. And even whatever we make in that regard should be affirmed by Vaishnava's guru.
Some progress, you know, towards devotional service, trying to realize, get the mercy of the Lord. I suppose involves our training, which means, you know, your own personal sadhana, reading, and you can see that Prabhupada and some other disciples have stressed so much on that. Mm-hmm. But why is it that a lot of us cannot focus or you know, do that in the sense that as a grahast, you know, we are working, we have family, but we just, you know, it comes in phases. For a couple of days, you read an hour a day, and then suddenly it goes away. And it is something which is not happening regularly, which I assume and is most important for doing all what you are saying. So is it because we lack faith that the 2 hours that I will, or the 1 hour that I will give for reading is not going to benefit me in my personal and business life, and of course my spiritual life? What is the reason that...
Well, lack of faith may be part of it. But on a very practical level, we should understand Srimad Bhagavatam says, by regularly hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam and regularly serving the pure devotee, all that is troublesome to the heart is relieved in pure devotional service to the Supreme Lord, was glorified by these exalted prayers, is established as an irrevocable fact. You know, it may be that we don't have implicit faith that this is the top priority in our life. It may be distractions, it may be a particular ashram, but all these things are interrelated. It's all part of the complexities of our condition. But one important thing to understand, I like to cite Charakuni. Not Charakuni, he said, whatever you do, beg, borrow, steal, get, need. Charakuni, the great Ayurvedic, very theistic, pure-hearted Ayurvedic physician, he said a wonderful thing in terms of healing and disease. He said, the most virulent disease is one that's cultivated over a long period of time by bad habits. And the most potent remedy is that which is taken regularly. Charakuni was a very theistic Ayurvedic physician. And, you know, his physical therapies was all in relation to, you know, offering prayers to the Brahmins and cows and all these Vaishnava concepts. But what he's emphasizing in terms of disease and conversely healing is regularity, not huge doses. It's not huge doses of the right poison that's going to, you know, purify our nearly eternal disease. It's altering our habits of indulging in things that are contrary to our spiritual health, into habits that are conducive. Because conditioning is something that develops over time, despite our moment-to-moment decisions and practices. So, in the chanting of the Holy Name, in the study of the Scripture, or any spiritual endeavor, if it's all haphazard, you know, a lot one day and minimal the next, the effect will be much less than something that may be more minimal, but regular. And part of the regularity is the commitment. And that's why, you know, devotees sometimes question, what is the magic in 16 rounds? Or as Mahaprabhu, when he was, you know, meeting so many Brahmins wanting to invite him for lunch, that he couldn't receive all their invitations. And he said, I will accept the invitation of one who is a master without 100,000. 100,000? What? Coins? Gold coins? Well, we all together don't have that much. So, and he got despondent. No, he didn't understand. 100,000 holy names. And they were alive. Yeah. But it's not, the magic is not in 100,000 holy names or 16 rounds or 64 rounds. The empowerment is in the commitment to the authorized representative of the Lord. A large degree of empowerment is in commitment. Any relationship requires commitment to blossom. There's an empowerment to the act of commitment, because it means you're placing your spiritual nature, you're curtailing somewhat of your conditioned nature by a commitment to a certain level or standard of spiritual involvement. So, for initiation, Srila Prabhupada requested a vow to chant 16 rounds. So for anyone who is sincerely taking up the path, you know, we can't change the minimum standard that Srila Prabhupada has established, but we can say that rather than be haphazard in your application, set a reasonable commitment as to how much you can chant, how much you can study, how much you can offer, and keep to it. And some days you can do more, which is fine. And some days you're going to be tempted to do less, which is an opportunity. On days when we're challenged to even offer our bare minimum of commitment, we have an opportunity to make more benefit. Because on days when somehow the modes or whatever makes it easy to chant and study, and we think we're just doing so great because it's easy, you may not be making as much advancement on another day where it's just incredibly difficult, your mind's all distracted, you don't have a lot of time, there's a lot of disturbance, but you stick to the commitment. Because what Krishna is looking at is the sacrifice, which is greater when it's difficult than when it's easy, in most cases. But the important thing is regularity. You know, establish some bare minimum. Not the bare minimum, but some commitment that you can adhere to, that you can follow, and do it without fail. And if some days, like, you know, sometimes somebody will be in an accident, they'll be in a coma for a few days or something. You can make up for it after if you have a legitimate, you know, reason why it just could not be done. But that commitment, is something you can offer on a regular basis. That regulation creates a kind of conditioning of a spiritual sort. You do it every day. And what is conditioning really? It's not such a mystical phenomenon. It's basically habit. What you do regularly becomes habitual. So if you do the right thing regularly, even if not such a tremendous degree of it, but it's the right thing, then you become conditioned to your spiritual nature, which is your actual, real nature. And then the more that becomes, you know, awakened, then the more you're going to want to get, you can actually increase. So the important thing is the regularity, what you can do regularly. And on days when you can do more, like you can obviously holy days, do whatever you can, but don't go below your minimum on other days. That's very conducive to spiritual advancement.
So you mentioned that perhaps, I don't know if I understood properly, that it should be realistic, you know, so that it is that.
Yeah, I think it should. Prabhupada, again, he's the perfect personification of practical application of the highest spiritual truths. He was a very practical person. So look at practically what you can do on a daily basis. And if you commit to that, it makes substantial advancement.
Which means that we need to spend some time in the day, you know, just to be introspective, just think, you know, what have I done? Am I sticking to the level? You know,
yeah.
Which a lot of us, I don't know what others are, when you're, you know, family, work, everything, they just...
Well, harmony doesn't mean just different living entities interacting. It means different aspects of ourself. Srila Prabhupada gave us a process in which there's an introspective period of meditation called japa. When you're going into the darkness of your heart with the illumination of the holy name to, you know, to drive out those things that thrive in darkness, which are called anattas, and illumine, you know, the deepest core where Bhakti Lata Bhita is trying to take root. And needs some, you know, light and life and nourishment and nurturing that comes from the holy name. So Krishna consciousness has its introspective dimension. But basically, Braj Leela does not have hermits and recluses, at least in the Nitya Leela. In the Boma Leela there may be recluses, but but the recluses in Boma Leela are not meant for an eternal life of seclusion. They're meant to, you know, become more introspective for the sake of more harmonious loving relationships. The goal is not introspection and, you know, seclusion. It's the goal of all these things is more harmonious loving dealings. Which you see in Braj Leela is just all loving relationships. There's no competition. There's no conflict. There's no enmity or envy, polluting and contaminating and making relationships nasty. Everyone is encouraging, inspiring, assisting one another to do better, to be more gentle, more kind, more loving, more compassionate. Why? For the pleasure of Krishna. Because, you know, if you're being kind, I'm being nasty, it's not pleasing to Krishna. If we're all being kind and soft and gentle and loving and caring and sharing for the pleasure of Krishna, that attracts his presence, his empowerment, his energy, his shakti. And then everything becomes sweet. And then hearts become soft. And we know that Krishna is very attached to butter to the extent he's always stealing butter. So as we said before, the Leela of the Lord is not something to be taken symbolically or allegorically. It is the absolute truth. But the absolute truth is rich in symbology. What is it that's so irresistible about soft butter for Krishna? He likes soft hearts. And as butter is the essence of milk, a soft heart is the essence of a pure soul. And then Krishna, he wants that. He'll take it and he'll fashion it into whatever is the perfection of that soul's existence. I forgot what the question was, but I'll find it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Krishna Maharaj Jai.
Jai.